This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. Solicitor General Elena Kagan is President Obama's pick to be the next member of the U.S. Supreme Court. The nomination already has interested parties from all points of view supporting or opposing the choice. Kagan has never been a judge, but there are aspects of her record that have some rejoicing and others crying foul. The choice for a Supreme Court justice is among the most political actions of a U.S. president, and its ramifications can be long-lasting. It's Politics Day, and we'll talk about it with Stephen Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, and New Hampshire-based analyst Arnie Arneson. We'll also take your phone calls and emails at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org and 866-780-9100. Politics Day on Talk of Iowa, coming up after this check of the news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio.
And we're having some problems connecting to our studio in Des Moines, but I'll say hello to Stefan and Arnie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And, it's the rain. Iowa has been hit by lightning and rain and flooding, and you know it's the gutter Demerung out there.
I know we've had some very heavy rain. We're getting heavy rain now moving into the eastern part of Iowa and some scattered very strong thunderstorms. So what's happening in the world of politics, guys?
Oh, nothing.
Nothing.
Right now I'm writing a piece about the Obama administration cleaving the very infamous Minerals Management Service into two. Nobody had ever heard of the Minerals Management Service until they discovered that they were spending a lot of money having sex and rock and rolling and doing stuff at their Denver office instead of managing minerals properly. And this service, as it turns out, is responsible for scrutinizing the oil industry as well as promoting the oil industry and then reaping royalties from them. And those two things obviously are totally incompatible. And it's kind of like banks also selling securities and getting involved in, you know, very risky investments. And so the Ken Salazar, the Interior Secretary, has said that President Obama wants to split that thing in two and, I guess, have one part of it to promote the oil industry, but really have now due diligence, because it's becoming clear that the oil spill was not only a sort of accident, which it really was, but that also there was a lack of sufficient scrutiny, that the oil industry has been allowed to do a lot of its own sort of self-regulation.
A wink and a nod. I mean, it was like, don't worry, boys, trust us. Don't worry, boys, trust. Do you realize what we were trusting them with? We are trusting them with our coastline. We are trusting them with our fish industry. We are trusting them with our beaches. We are trusting them with our oysters. I mean, where's my oysters on the half shell? I mean, when you realize what we were trusting them with, you would never, on a micro level, allow this kind of behavior. You know, when you look at what happens when you want to put an addition on your house, and the zoning people come in, and the planning board people come in, and you have the licensing, and then you have the approvals, and then they have to think about what happens at the micro level in your own city and town, and then look at the basic sort of carte blanche that was allowed to the oil and gas industry, where they, you know, weren't asked to spend the extra $500,000 for some kind of additional turnoff or whatever it was. It is outrageous, Stefan. And the other thing that's more outrageous is that not only did we never hear of this group before, but it turns out that I think next to the IRS, they produce more revenue for the federal government than anywhere else. So talk about being awash in cash.
Well, just knowing
how much money is pouring, and I'm going to use the word pouring into the Minerals Management Service, makes you understand why, at a minimum, dividing them is critical. More important is, who the heck was responsible for oversight?
Well, that's right.
I'm so upset.
You know, I'm a member, an affiliate of the Nova University Oceanographic Center in Florida, and I've worked with them for over 10 years, and I had some interesting information from them in the last day. They are now looking at what is going to happen to this oil spill. There are currents in the Gulf of Mexico that sweep essentially back east, and they sweep to the Florida Channel, past Key West and into the Florida Keys. And as soon as they go there, they get swept up into the Gulf Stream, which then goes up the east coast of Florida, up the east coast of the United States, swirls back up again from the north past, the Great Britain and Ireland. And they are now pretty sure that as this thing spreads bigger and bigger, those currents are going to actually drive it into the Gulf Stream. So when you talk about the consequences of it, it is not going to be Louisiana. It's not going to be Louisiana, Alabama, and Florida. It is potentially going to be much greater, and it's not just going to be the coastal area and the shallow coastal zones, especially, for example, for fish and Arnie's oysters and clams and other things, but it's also going to be farther out offshore in the benthic environment, which is where you have the really large fish, where you have
I want everyone to call in and tell us, what is a legitimate claim? Did you hear that word? First of all, it was like a circular firing squad the other day when they were testifying before Congress at the hearings.
Yeah.
It was like, as someone said, it was like watching kids in kindergarten going, no, it's your fault. Now it's your fault. Now it's your fault. And I'm looking at all of them and I'm going, I want to like wash all your mouths out with soap. I'm so upset.
So
but what I
want
to know is what is a legitimate claim? And I think people should start calling in because the insurance companies never want to cover you
because
the last thing what they want to say is that they're responsible. Imagine how these boys are going to narrow scope what is a legitimate claim.
And what it is already, I wouldn't be surprised if BP is putting out, you know, like a $100 million scholarship program to create new lawyers really quickly because they're going to need a lot of lawyers because this is going to be the full employment act for all of those unemployed lawyers that lost their jobs when the economy crashed because the liability issue is absolutely incredible. And what I found most fascinating was that you get not only BP, but Halliburton,
The
company that actually was managing that platform.
Yep.
You know, and now they not only were they kind of blaming each other, but they're going to be suing each other because, the Halliburton says, well, you know, we kind of produced the concrete platform for it and it was done to specifications, but the company that was managing this mismanaged it. BP says, well, we weren't running this thing. We were just leasing it. And, you know, we just process oil. We don't deal with platforms and shutoff valves. So it's their fault. So it's not only going to be fishermen and beach resorts and the boating industry, even the shipping industry apparently right now is ready to sue because they are not going to be allowed to transport through the area where the oil slick is, and so it's going to delay shipments to the Gulf ports and so on.
Can I ask a question? And we were talking before about the fact that all of a sudden we're learning about this mineral management service that nobody ever heard of before.
Yeah.
Can I ask a favor? I want to call my good friend Bernie Sanders because Bernie's on a roll, okay? He's getting the feds audited, and he got it with unanimous vote out of the United States Senate. I love it. Socialist Bernie leads. As the world turned upside down, it is like unbelievable. But why am I talking about Bernie, and why am I talking about the audit? And that is that as you were describing this service that nobody ever heard about, that had a clear conflict of interest. I mean, there was no way that they could actually do the kind of oversight that was required. Can I bring everyone back to Enron and Arthur Andersen? Because remember Arthur Andersen, the accounting firm that also had a conflict of interest, that it was doing the advising and the auditing at the same time, the consulting, and everyone said, oh, that's disgusting. And Arthur Andersen basically disappeared off the planet because that they could not become aware that they were a walking conflict of interest was basically problematic.
Well, they didn't disappear. They're called Accenture. You know, accident that they had was a guy who was being whacked with a golf club instead of him whacking golf balls with clubs.
But my point is this, is that what drove them to dissolve and then reinvent themselves was the conflict of interest.
Well, sure.
I want someone to call Bernie, and I want someone to call Ron Paul. And I think we need to do an audit of the government. And any time we see a conflict of interest in the government, we need to divide and change their behavior. Because the Mineral Management Service is not the only boys in town that have the same conflict. We've seen it happen over and over again. That's one of the reasons why Blanche Lincoln has that bill about derivatives. She's saying to banks, hey, wait a minute, honey, we're not going to insure you if you're going to exhibit risky behavior. So spin off your risky behavior or stop being insured. You know, again, there are so many conflicts that if you and I can see them, you know they are glaring and obvious. My question is, where's Congress? Why have they been asleep at the switch?
Let's go to the phones. John in Des Moines is on the line. John, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Good morning.
All right.
Interesting topics. There's all kinds of things going on in this world, aren't there?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
My point I'd like to make today is how many warnings are we going to have to get before we realize that hydrocarbons are not the way to go for our energy? You know, we had the Exxon Valdez, now we've had this, and there's been many other oil spills around the world that haven't been publicized quite as much as these two big ones have. But, you know, we're forcing the balance of nature here as human beings, and, you know, we think we're so smart. Well, I don't think we're that smart when we get things out of whack. And not only is it on the beginning side of getting the energy, but after we use it and throw the waste out into the environment, you know, this...
John, let me ask you, though, the dependence on that kind of fuel is based largely on the fact that so far it's been incredibly cheap for us. Do you think that people would be willing to pay, you know, two or three times transportation costs to go to a different system?
Well, we're going to have to. You know, there's just no other alternative unless we want to start eating oil-encrusted
But it's never been cheap.
Food.
Can I tell you something? The problem is that's the fiction, Jonathan. It's not even relative, because we don't do cradle-to-grave analysis and then we charge for that. Because we don't include the price of cleanup. Because we don't include the price of global warming. Because we don't include the price of going to war. Because we don't include... If you look at the real cost of oil and gas, it is enormous. It is enormous. But we are in denial. We have denied the real cost. We have basically passed it on to consumers. We've shifted it on to the debt. We have claimed that it's a war when it's all about oil. I mean, come on. Why were we in Iraq? So, you know, it had nothing to do with the dictator in charge. It had to do with the fact that we were so concerned about what was happening to that oil and who was going to have access to it. That's been the problem. And I think the wake-up call isn't just what's going on in the Gulf, because it turns out everybody lied, but we've been lying to ourselves about the cost. And now it's coming back in such a glaring way that we can't avoid it anymore.
We'll try to wrap up this topic and move on to President Obama's choice for the Supreme Court, Elena Kagan. That's coming up on Politics Day here on Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. After a short break, we're speaking with Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University and New Hampshire's Arnie Arneson. More of Politics Day on Talk of Iowa coming up in just a moment, plus your phone calls and emails, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org and 866-780-9100. We'll be back in a minute. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's Politics Day. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are with us, talking about a variety of topics. I want to take one more phone call on our previous discussion here. We're going to go to Clinton. And, Clinton, welcome to the show. Where are you calling from?
Keister, Minnesota, small town up on the border here. Where I can see Iowa from here.
Close enough.
Yep, how do we look?
Absolutely. Say, you know, I was just thinking about with farm chemicals and stuff and farm fertilizers and drugs we get out of the drugstore or whatever, a whole host of products in the United States of America that, you know, we can't buy them, we can't use them until they've gone through rigorous testing and, you know, to see if they're going to, well, maybe kill the ground, kill the people, kill whatever. And yet at the same point, one of the biggest excuses here is, well, that's deeper than we've ever drilled before. And, oh, we don't use those backups. You know, we don't have a backup. Mm-hmm. We don't have a plan. We don't have a containment dome, and we haven't tested anything. Extremely curious, other than the fact that when I drive down the freeway and see nobody slowing down to start using less oil, how can they get away with that? And how come nobody has asked, why don't they have to have some sort of test when they go to a new area, when they get that permit? Why don't they have to, well, yes, we've tested it, and we can assure you that we've got this backup plan ready to go. Nobody's even asked that.
Well, I got it. Too big to be safe. Too big to be, you got it, everyone? That's the bumper sticker. We're selling it now. We're raising money for Iowa Public Radio. Too big to be safe. And that's, think about it. That's true with the banks. That's true with the energy companies. It is like the bigger you get, the greater likelihood is that the government is looking the other way or assuming that they can trust you to ensure the safety and soundness of the behavior. And what have we discovered in both the economic and financial world? What are we discovering in the oil and gas world is they don't tell you the truth.
Well, the other thing is that, in fact, there has been a very prominent philosophy, and it's been promoted largely by Republicans, but clearly Democrats bought into it as a subterfuge, and that is that you really don't want to interfere with business because government doesn't know what it's doing, and you want to let business do business, and this is a capitalist country, and so you need to have companies be able to go out and actually produce products and services and do business with a minimum amount of government interference and regulation. And that's a fine balance between over-regulating, which chokes off entrepreneurship and kills companies, makes people not want to start businesses, which is happening in many places, including Iowa, where our taxes are a little too much. And there are, in fact, in some cases, regulations that are onerous and not regulating enough so that you have these things happen. The Scandinavian countries and Scotland require their offshore oil drilling platforms to have a much more sophisticated shutoff system that everybody thinks if it had been on this particular BP platform would have successfully shut down. So, you know, the American oil companies fought that and we said, well, OK, you know, whatever you have is sufficient. Let's not put too much cost and burden on them. And so, you know, you're always finding that you didn't regulate enough. And I think, as Arnie says, we did the same thing with the financial services industry and the real estate industry. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they are now the single largest holder of bad mortgages in the United States. And our bailout of the whole system is largely funneling enormous amounts of taxpayer money to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which, as you know, were created by Lyndon Johnson, not by a Republican, as a way of sort of secretly giving public money to people to buy homes when that would not have sold very well as a kind of a housing welfare program. So, you know, it's only when things go really bad that we go back and look and say, well, this was not a good idea. And, you know, in this case,
the irony is with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was that Congress was looking at how much money was being made in the private market. And they kept saying to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, why aren't you acting like those guys? Why aren't you making money like those guys? Why don't you behave like those guys? So they said, okay, fine. We're going to behave just like those guys. And then all of a sudden we found out that why they were making so much money was because it wasn't legit. Because they were liar loans. Because it was all this. So all of a sudden Fannie Mae jumps into the same sort of swamp that the private markets were, but they were actually bigger, and they had the force and the effect of looking like they were government operating.
But we also wanted people who really could not afford to buy a house to be able to buy a house, and that's clear in every assessment of what happened in that industry. We said home ownership is the value of America. That is where people, it's your home is your castle. That's what sets us apart from countries where people rent. Well, renting is very smart if you don't have a large income and you don't want to have a commitment to an asset that is not movable. You know, if you find a job somewhere else, you know, if you're renting, you know, you got a contract, you can break it. Home ownership became an almost religious sort of institution where, you know, everybody should have a house. And it turned out that was unrealistic and crazy.
Let me tell you the problem. The problem isn't home ownership per se. It's when you look at your home like it's an ATM machine. When a home is not shelter, but a home is something to flip. A home is something to basically burden with debt. A home is something that only will gain in value, like somehow the real estate market doesn't tank. And I think part of the problem is that if you look at what's happened in other countries around the world, and we are such snobs because we never look at what other countries do, they not only rent, but what they also do is they control the amount of profit that you can pull out of a house. They maintain a level of affordability in home ownership that has never happened in this country. They say if people are low income and they want to buy a house, what they can't do is cash out.
But a lot of people, you know, who had no, a lot of people who had no jobs, people who went in and filled out a form and they said, how much do you make? Well, I make $150,000, and they were making $12,000 a year.
That's called a liar's loan.
Well, that's right, exactly. So it wasn't people, you know, flipping their homes and doing all that. It was a lot of people who should have never been given loans, and it's unfortunate, but, well, you know, these are people with low incomes or no jobs.
Isn't this just an extension, though, of
an economy that's based on people spending more money than they have? Is it
sure.
really different, that much different than people getting credit cards that they really have no business getting so that they can spend more so that the economy can keep moving?
No, I think it's also a situation where nobody is accountable. See, what happened is the only way you can do a liar loan, Stefan, is if the person who is issuing the mortgage isn't going to be responsible for it
sure.
because he knows he's going to shove it under the rug and someone else is going to have to eat it. As long as banks stop being banks and stop – a banker will never loan you money if the banker needs to be paid back. If a banker knows that it doesn't matter whether he gets paid back, he'll loan anyone money because it's not about him. He's not responsible. That's part of the problem. We have to continue to make the connection between what people buy and what people are loaned.
But
and once you break that connection, then everything falls apart.
And we're not doing that, and we will
not,
never do it. And I'll tell you what the next big crisis is, all right? You heard it here, not maybe first, but you heard it clearly. Higher education. We are putting money in unspeakable amounts into getting people to be able to afford to go to a college somewhere. And the people who are going to colleges that give them no education at all, some of these, you know, colleges that are basically nothing more than diploma mills, they're not learning anything. There are no jobs for most of those people. They are borrowing money that's largely part of Obama's stimulus package to get students to a college. And those students are not going to be able to repay any of those loans. And there are already warning signs, even before this massive amount of money is being spent, that there is going to be an enormous default rate on those college loans because we're training people for all the wrong things. And in many cases, we're giving them education that's worthless, and it's all being charged against the federal taxpayer.
Even if you're right, though, isn't that a very difficult sell job? Because essentially what we're talking about is rewriting the American dream and saying, you know, owning a home and going to college, it's going to be a lot harder than it used to be.
Yeah, it is going to be a lot harder. And I saw some numbers that were alarming, which was that there are a huge number of jobs for people like the people we don't want to let into this country illegally anymore, and we're not giving them work permits to come to this country. Those are jobs that don't require even a high school education, much less a college education. We're not going to be able to fill those because somebody who's on welfare and has got a terrific stream of income that lets them live minimally is not going to want to take one of those jobs. And people who are getting college educations in fields where there isn't a single job in the entire United States, and they're borrowing a huge amount of money, and they're borrowing it against the federal government, those people are going to go bankrupt. And guess who's going to end up, Arnie? You, me, and Jonathan and a couple of people are going to end up with that bill when that chicken comes home to roost. And we're saying people shouldn't be doing that with the oil industry and the financial services and real estate. Well, now we're starting a whole new line of unreasonable credit because it is, quote, the right thing to do. We need to get everybody into a college. And the data does not seem to prove that at all.
Well, at some point we have to talk about something else which is kind of related to this and your concern about college. It's called structural unemployment. I'll explain later.
Well, and ooh. That might have – we're going to talk about Elena Kagan after this.
Oh, yeah,
this
we'll talk about her. She's looking for a job, too, though. She's looking for a job. Remember that.
Yeah, there you go. It's the Elena Kagan employment issue. That's
employment
coming up
issue, exactly.
After this break. We're going to take a break for the Environment Report. We'll talk about Elena Kagan and the Supreme Court after this break on Talk of Iowa.
Climate bill chances slim to none, so is this really the right time for it? This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. The Senate is releasing its version of a climate and energy bill. Mark Brush is here. You've been talking with some political insiders who say it's now or never for action on this energy and climate legislation.
Yeah, most of the environmental groups I talk to say that Gulf oil spill is highlighting the need for this energy legislation. And some political observers say Democrats will never have a bigger majority in the Senate than they do now. So now's the time to pass the Kerry Lieberman bill. But there are some others out there saying there's no need to rush things and that really this energy bill should be good policy first. I talked with Frank O'Donnell. He's with the environmental group Clean Air Watch.
There appears to be this real race to try to get something done before the window closes. The best kind of public policy is not always carved out under those kind of circumstances.
O'Donnell says the conventional wisdom that there will be no better time than the present, that could be wrong. He believes there will be other opportunities to pass this kind of legislation in the future.
So does anybody believe that the Democrats have the votes to pass this because the Republicans aren't going to vote for this?
Right, and that's what Harry Reid is saying. He's saying if they don't get 60 votes, he's not going to allow it to go forward.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Sure.
This is the Environment Report. So, mowed the lawn this week. You know, it looks okay when it's all trimmed and no weeds. Well, not exactly no weeds. It's always got some dandelions and stuff. I don't even know what it is. I know it's not grass. I guess I could have somebody come out, spray pesticides, take care of the weeds and the grubs and the bugs, but I don't want to get locked into that whole routine, and I really don't like the idea of all those chemicals anyway. Rebecca Williams has talked to some pesticide folks. They say those chemicals are safe to use on the lawn if you use them correctly. You know, follow the directions on the label. But she also talked to some experts who say you might not need pesticides at all and still have a weed-free lawn.
A lot of people say there's no point in using chemicals just to make your lawn look good. Jay Feldman is with the group Beyond Pesticides. He says of the 30 most common lawn pesticides, most of them are suspected by the Environmental Protection Agency to cause cancer, birth defects, or other health problems.
EPA knows this information. Why not remove pesticides from the equation, especially in light of the fact that they're not really necessary?
So if you decide you're going to remove pesticides from the equation, what do you do? That's a question Kevin Frank gets a lot. He's an extension agent at Michigan State University and an expert on lawns. He says a healthy, dense lawn is actually really good at fighting off weeds and pests all on its own. So how do you get a healthy, dense lawn without a lot of chemicals? Frank says it might take a couple years to get there, and it means going against conventional lawn advice.
We've done a great deal of research up here at Michigan State that essentially runs contrary to what I call turf dogma of, you know, water deeply and infrequently. And we've shown that if you do it on a more frequent basis, you end up with a healthier plant overall.
He recommends watering lightly, just 10 minutes every day, instead of soaking the lawn once a week. You'll actually use less water. Frank says it's also good to fertilize twice a year, use a mulch mower, and mow high instead of giving the grass a buzz cut. He says that could make your lawn so healthy, it might mean you won't need to spray or hire someone to spray your lawn.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are our guests for this Politics Day. And President Obama named his pick for the vacancy on the Supreme Court, Solicitor General Elena Kagan. Nominating a Supreme Court justice can be one of the most long-lasting impacts a president can have on the country. So, Steph, Arnie, what do you think of the pick of Elena Kagan?
She's young. Oh, excuse me.
She's Jewish.
She's from New York. Oh, see,
she's
she had a bar mitzvah. Let's see, what else
she's
can I tell
woman.
You? She's single. She's single. That's all we know. And she worked at Harvard.
She's great. She has no real record beyond the fact that, as every Harvard president has done, she didn't allow the military to recruit at Harvard because of the Vietnam War and opposition to the Vietnam War, so they didn't want military recruiters on campus. Then later, it was because the military does not allow openly gay people to serve in it, and the Republicans are going to use every aluminum baseball bat they can find to beat her up on that one. And I've seen Laura Ingraham already screeching about that all over television. And other than that, she has very little record, which is the ideal situation for a nominee, because the opponents can't say, oh, in this case here, you wrote such and such, and over here, you know, you said such and such, and on a lot of the hot button issues, there's not much of a record. So that's good. On the other hand, I think she's not a good pick for other reasons, which Arnie disagrees with.
Well, first of all, let's go back to the comment regarding not allowing recruiters to recruit on the Harvard campus. You brought up what happened during the 60s when it was, you know, the Vietnam War. Yeah. That was not Kagan. Kagan had nothing to do with that. So don't bring in that.
She wasn't even born yet.
Right. Well, right. But she had nothing to do with that. And to bring that up is a distraction.
Unfair.
The reason why she did this was because they had a uniform policy that said that no employer that discriminates based on race, color, creed, or sexual preference was not going to be able to recruit. That included the government, whether it was the government that was maybe recruiting for, I don't know what it is, but we all know that the only place that the government actually cares about your sexual preference, or at least claims to care, is in the U.S. military, until they find out that the people that they're asking to leave are the only ones that speak Urdu and all the other languages that they turn out to need. But remember, this was consistency is what she was saying. If we wink and nod on the government, then how can we not wink and nod at any other employer that comes in that basically has the same requirement? And that's what that was about. And that was why she basically took it all the way to the court. She lost, but there is nothing wrong in being consistent. And that's really what this was all about.
I didn't say there was anything wrong. All I said was this is the one thing that but Harvard and the East Coast schools never wanted the military recruiting on their campuses because of the Vietnam War. And that's been a long tradition in the elite East Coast schools, which, by the way, is where almost every Supreme Court justice comes from. They don't have any Supreme Court justices from Nevada, Iowa, or from Concord, New Hampshire, or from Oklahoma City. And so there is the part I don't like about the appointment is there will now be not a single Protestant on the court, which is ludicrous for anyone who has even not so much an affirmative action view of the world, but at least a kind of diversity view of the world. It's ridiculous. The United States is mostly Protestant, not Catholic and Jewish. And secondly, that it's another person with a very limited East Coast intellectual experience in the elite schools of the East Coast who produce an inordinate and disproportionate number of all the people that occupy top positions in our country, which is why they are very often so out of touch with people in the rest of the country.
Well, I don't know. There's a fair amount of geographic diversity on the court. All of the boroughs of New York will be represented.
That's right, Bronx, that's Brooklyn, right. Manhattan.
Right, it's a New Yorker cartoon view of the United States, which is, you know, here is 31st Street, and over here is Park Avenue, and over here is the Hudson River, and then after that, it's just a blur. You know, it's kind of like everything else in the rest of the country going west, you know, doesn't deserve more than just a couple of mountains and then a little line for the Pacific Ocean.
Well, first of all, in a country that separates religion and state, I don't care what her religious belief is. And frankly, before this, there were a lot of Unitarians on the court. And you know what Unitarians believe in? I have no clue. I mean, let's be honest.
The Great Turtle.
So the Great Turtle, exactly. So I hate to break it to you, but we probably have had a very non-diverse religious court before in the past. And to claim that Unitarians are part of the Protestant Church is fictitious, too, because I know most of my Unitarian friends are either agnostic or atheist,
well,
but they want
right.
to do something
but,
on Sunday
but,
morning.
But I always believe that the court should reflect something of the sort of overall cultural situation of the country within several decades or the lifetime of a Supreme Court justice, which I guess is 150 years. And this is a time when religion is high intensity, when there is great sensitivity about it, when there are issues that in fact are grounded and rooted in religious beliefs, and to alienate an entire segment of the United States because there is no one on the court who empathizes with a piece of the United States that you may not agree with, but that represents a huge percentage of Americans, is just not wise. I mean, as I said in my op-ed piece in Insider Iowa or wherever it was, that, you know, you don't want to delegitimize the court by alienating it from too large a percentage of Americans in terms of its intellectual roots, because then if the Supreme Court is viewed as illegitimate.
What does a Protestant want that a Jew doesn't? What does a Jew want that a Catholic doesn't? What does a Catholic want that a Baha'i doesn't? I mean, what I'm trying to figure out is walk in my shoes. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm walking in the Protestant shoes. What do I want different in America? You tell me. Do I want to go to church when I want to go to church? Absolutely. Do I want to send my kid to the school of my choice? Absolutely. Do I want to buy the car of my choice? What does a Protestant want that would somehow distinguish them from somebody else on the court? I don't quite understand that. So
well,
it's
Arnie, under that same line of argument, though, you could say, what does a woman want for America that
absolutely.
A man doesn't want? So let's just stay.
And for how many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds? I mean, for a long time, we didn't have women on the court. But more important, suddenly we notice that there isn't a Protestant on the court. For how many years did we not notice all the other things that weren't on the court? The fact is that the court is going to blend and change and evolve. And you are concerned about the New York piece. And I admit that there is a little bit of concern that they are from the Bronx and Brooklyn and Manhattan and Bay Ridge or wherever they're from. But if you ever go to New York, and I said this before, My grandparents came off the boat, and when they landed, the Brooklyn was as far as they got. But it was the next generation, their granddaughter, that ran for governor in New Hampshire. It was called the American Dream. A lot of us start in New York from all over the world, from Asia, from Haiti, from everywhere. And eventually we end up going somewhere else. But there's no crime to starting in New York. In fact, New York is kind of like the melting pot of the United States.
Well, with that track record, Arnie, your grandkids could make it as far west as Ohio.
Stop!
Well, that's right.
So let's back off a little bit and let's talk about the political ramifications of this, because Elena Kagan has not served as a judge, which recently that's unusual for Supreme Court nominees. Going back further in history, it's actually quite common. There have already been very liberal groups who are complaining that Obama is blowing a chance to get a big liberal on the court. There are conservatives who say she's way too liberal. There are people that say she doesn't have enough experience. There are people who say that that she doesn't have as much experience, and that's a good thing to get an outside version. Yeah. Politically, with everything else that's going on and all of the fights that Obama has in front of him, can you assess his choice in terms of, do you think it's going to go through relatively easily, and how will it affect other things that he's pushing Congress to accomplish?
Not jobs. The only thing people are going to care about when they walk into the voting booth in 2010 is the economy, is the economy, is the economy. Stefan, I don't really see having any kind of significant influence on anybody's vote in 2010.
Well, that's probably true, but it's my responsibility. I'm looking right here at my contract to make trouble. So I'm saying that Jonathan had made a brilliant point, which is we don't need a black on the court. We don't need Sotomayor on the court, a proud Hispanic woman, because a bunch of white guys have the same views and ambitions and yearnings, and they all came from immigrants.
I don't think that's what I said, Stefan.
No, but I said it, because you said, then why do we need women if we don't need religious diversity or regional diversity? We need age diversity.
Here's what I'm going to do. I think what we should do is, I think we should go back to from 1776 and look at the court, and I think what we should do is we should religion, color, code, and average. You know what? If you go back, there were mostly white Protestant men for the first couple of hundred years, so it's okay. We can handle a handful of years with Catholics and Jews. I think it's not going to suddenly change the nature of the court. And frankly, this court isn't making decisions as much as we would like based on their Catholicism or their Judaism. They're making decisions based on the policy and the Constitution and the economy and the politics of the day.
And
I understand that there's a religious flavor to some of this, but I don't think that the Protestant piece should be a piece that is offensive to most Americans.
Well, it's probably not offensive, but on the other hand, really, Arnie, let's be honest here. The court really operates on the basis of, okay, you're appointing me in order to replace this liberal guy who just retired, and that will leave 4-4-1 with Kennedy kind of occasionally the swing vote between the four conservatives who very often win all cases, because they're usually 5-4 with the conservatives winning. And so Elena Kagan fits perfectly into the liberal enough, but not so liberal that the senators from the Republican side, or even some Democrats perhaps, would say, oh no, boy, this is way left wing, no confirmation here. So she basically is a replacement. She's like, you replace the black Supreme Court justice who died with another African American, because that's the black slot. You replace a woman with another woman. Now you've replaced two women and now perhaps three women, which is extraordinary, because you're starting to see some sort of greater gender sort of representation, at least of the total population, which is more than 50% women. But Elena Kagan is confirmable. She's young and hopefully healthy, so she'll be there forever and probably outlive Clarence Thomas, which is the goal of Democrats, is to put somebody in there who can outlive Clarence Thomas. And she will probably not bolt on Obama and suddenly turn right wing and vote with the four conservatives and make it, a conservative majority of five.
Well, and let me also make one other point here, and that is that, she has never really operated in a courtroom setting until recently when, President Obama appointed her. And the thing that makes me a little bit nervous is that when she did appear before the court, there was significant hostility between Roberts and her. I mean, it was not even, it wasn't sort of this respectful disagreement. It was almost kind of an open hostility.
But she got along really well with Scalia, and that's a justice that has a much bigger reputation for being hard on people.
No, but you know what's interesting? Do you know who Scalia's best friend is on the court? Ruth Ginsburg.
Yeah.
Ruth is the best. So Scalia is an interesting animal on so many different levels, and Ruth adores him, and these two people are, and here's the, that's the beauty of the court that people don't know. I think they need to understand some of the social dynamics on the court because we have lost that in Congress. It is so hard now for conservatives and liberals to have a conversation in the U.S. Congress. But it turns out that on the Supreme Court, where you're appointed for life, people have managed to have relationships when they are so ideologically apart, and yet they adore each other. And I think the story of Scalia and Ruth Ginsburg is just a fabulous story.
Bob from Bettendorf wanted to point out that Kagan sided with the prosecutors from Pottawatomie County in an issue, a racial issue in that community. And Bob believes that that's a black mark on Kagan's record because Kagan claimed sovereign immunity from prosecutors. I guess the reason I'm bringing that up is, to what extent do you judge her performance as Solicitor General to indicate her position when the job of Solicitor General isn't to make a decision, but it's to enforce the you're a lawyer.
Right.
You do what your client tells you to do. You don't make a decision necessarily.
You are the lawyer for the President of the United States and for the government of the United States. And so you are often making arguments that contradict your own personal judicial position or temperament, because that's very often also the way attorney generals operate. You know, you're basically not a freelancer. So you can make the case, yes, you know, that this was bad, but then blame Obama and the Obama administration, I guess, maybe.
Well, and I think Bob's point is very well taken, is that here's a case that you know, a lot of people felt very strongly about. And do you think the American public, or maybe more importantly, the senators who are responsible for confirming this position, are going to be able to separate, well, she was just being an attorney doing what her client told her to do and not advocating a particular position?
I think there are a lot of attorneys on the in the United States Congress. And I think
there might be one or two, yeah.
Might be one or two, and I think that they have been in positions where they have represented clients that they don't like, clients that they don't respect, and maybe even sometimes clients that they don't completely believe. And they understand that, and they're making the argument within the law that you can make to support that client's position. They understand that, and I think to some extent they can also understand her position. My question is, and I said this before and I will say it again, the most important question they should ask this potential justice is, when will she know to recuse herself?
Well,
you see, that is becoming more and more problematic. Justice Thomas has no capacity to recuse himself. He does not know when he is facing a conflict. That is a problem for me and for my trust in the Supreme Court. My question for Ms. Kagan is, when does she consider it appropriate for her to, in fact, recuse herself, and will she have the capacity to do that?
Yes, but you forget that the purpose of these hearings is not that at all. The purpose of these hearings is for the Democrats to try and build as much protective cover and armament around her, for her to answer as few questions as possible that might, you know, be difficult, and for the Republicans to probe for every single little weakness in her armor and then try to penetrate it and destroy her candidacy. That's the purpose of these hearings. It's not what all of you guys are talking about, which is judicial questions and law and constitutional issues. There's, you know, this is an era of brutal, bloody fist fights in which the purpose of the Republicans is to stop every appointment of the Obama administration that they can possibly stop. And they've stopped most judicial appointments that Obama has done are on hold. There are endless openings in the federal judiciary where the courts are overburdened because the Republicans won't release these nominees. And so, you know, you have to be realistic about what these hearings are about. I think she'll get confirmed, by the way.
Well, and I guess that in that context, Stefan, does the choice of Kagan, someone who isn't a judge, who has less of a record, who is pretty unanimously viewed as a real expert on constitutional law, does her vanilla character in some respects lessen the bloodbath?
Yes. It does, because it makes it really hard for Chuck Grassley, honestly. I mean, he came out with some statement today about how this is very important and this is someone who has no experience and this person is going to be there for the rest of their life. I'll bet you he'll vote for her, because you can't say no continuously on everything, even when there is a reasonable individual that most people can say, wow, this is a really smart person, and you still are saying no. Eventually, I think it's going to eat away at the credibility of saying no. Saying no is an important and really, really valuable function for the opposition to take, because it slows down bad decisions. But when you slow down things that really hurt the country, and when there isn't any compelling reason for it, I think it backfires on you. So, yeah, I think she's a good pick for the reason that you said.
And she's a brilliant teacher, Jonathan. Everyone said that she was amazing in front of a classroom, you know, that she was just able to just get her students so engaged. And I think the last thing the Republicans are going to want is to have her get up in front of Congress once again. Now we will be focusing really more on her than the first time she was reviewed by the Senate, and be this remarkable, charming, intelligent, you know, great teacher. And what's your reason for saying no?
Arnie is so good at this, because teaching and informing the American public is really an important role. Supreme Court justices go out all the time, and we have our friends at Drake University, for example. They have some wonderful annual meetings where they bring in Supreme Court justices to sit and talk and explain. And this is very important, because law is so complicated and so often, you know, puzzling, that to have someone who probably will be a great teacher, if she's confirmed, of why the court is making decisions, will be very valuable to maintain the legitimacy of the court, to explain
Absolutely.
It to ordinary people.
Actually, that is, I mean, ask David Souter. One of his incredible regrets is when he realizes how much people don't understand the importance of the judicial branch of government, how it is actually it's pivotal to a flourishing democracy. And that's one of the things he's done, is really said we need to get more involved in understanding the civics of this country and the judicial system in this country. And I think putting her on the bench will be really putting someone in a robe who can then walk off that bench and continue to teach why what she does and the other members of the court do is so crucial for them. Amen.
But it'll be very interesting to see, you know, this confirmation, I think. You know, I'm looking forward to it a great deal.
Well, the last time somebody appointed someone without any judicial experience was Harriet Myers. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say that there are a lot of similarities here, but that one was dead in the water.
Other than breasts, we asked about it, and a law degree. That's it. Nothing else. I'm just telling you right now. And that George Bush made a mistake, and everybody knew it.
Including
Republicans.
Right.
That's my point. Yeah. Absolutely,
right.
They were mortified.
Right.
They were mortified, and I think there is just absolutely no comparison.
Yeah, because
the
fact
she
was a political operative inside the White House, whereas this person is a judicial authority, you know, from the get-go. And so I think, yes, there is some similarity in terms of the lack of experience in the court system, but no, I think she's going to survive this pretty well.
Well, and Arnie, you referenced Justice Souter. Anytime you have somebody without a long history, there could be some concern that this nominee will have a completely different political or judicial bent than expected.
Yeah.
Well, but let's also remember that Souter was the pick of Bush, and so it's a crapshoot. You really don't know until the person puts on that robe and sits with the other members of the bench and begins to explore and realize they have to live with the decisions they make. Nobody really knows. Nobody knows. I mean, you may have a sense of where this person will go, but until they do, I mean, Justice Souter, I admire, but I didn't want him on the bench. You need to know that. I was terrified of this choice, especially when I realized that people like John Sununu and George Bush were supporting him. I couldn't imagine that I would come to admire him. So, you know, it is that kind of sort of judicial crapshoot.
It's a pig and a poke, because once you get appointed for life, you know, that's pretty liberating. And so, you know, now you can really say how you view the world, what you think. So it's interesting.
And I'm going to be in Iowa this weekend. So if anybody wants to find out what I'm doing at Iowa State, check in.
Sure.
Thank you, Arnie Artisan, Stefan Schmidt. That's Politics Day for this week. We'll see you guys again next week. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio News. Our producer is Dennis Reese, assistance today from Christina Sarnelli and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions. You can drop us a line at any time at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us.